Welcome to episode 24 of All of Your Business. These are the vulnerable, authentic, and unfiltered stories of business owners whose currents raise tides that lift all of our businesses, communities, and dreams. Before we get started, we are proud to announce that All of Your Business podcast has received a 2020 X-Ray Podcast Award presented by X-Ray FM. X-Ray FM, purpose-driven media at 91.1 FM and 107.1 FM, and find them online at xray.fm. On this episode, we're pleased to welcome Teresa Rayford, founder of Don't Shoot Portland. And now your host, Michael Jonas.
So yeah, I'll just get into it. I'm really happy to talk to you. I know that we kind of know each other, you know, peripherally because we have like mutual friends and things, but I've never really got to talk to you at duration. So I'm excited about that.
Awesome. Yeah, I know. I kind of do busy work as an organizer. So I'm always kind of like pretty much delegating or begging. And so it's like I don't get times for discussions unless we're trying to kind of educate the public, as you know, like the dialogues and stuff like that. But most of the time when I'm out in the field, I already know what I'm going to do, but I disappear like personally. It's like my alter ego takes over. So I don't have time for, hey, how are you doing? It's like, I suppose, but it's like, yeah, grab that. Let's go over here. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, why we're here.
Well, you know, you're an activist and community organizer at heart, so you can't do community organizing if you're spending time going in circles or narrating. You know, you're just sort of like, I'm here, what do we need to do?
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know more about you, like your childhood. I don't even know, you know, where you're from. Are you from Portland?
Yeah, I was born and raised here. I grew up here. I went to King School and Tubman Middle School. And then went to Jefferson High School, obviously, Plantation. It was like, I had all this hope and then ended up in this hamster wheel. So I'm pretty kind of fluent in Portlandia. Both of my parents were born here. My mom's parents were born here. Well, not her mom. Her mom came up here from Louisiana. And then my grandma on my dad's side, they all came out here from Mississippi. And my grandpa came from St. Louis, but I'm pretty much fourth generation Oregonian. Great grandmother born in McMinnville back in the 1800s.
Oh.
It was like of Irish descent. So he's like, oh, okay, there's mixed families living in Southwest Portland back in the 20s and 40s and, you know, having 15 kids. So on this, it's a trip being from Portland because as a Black person, you're probably related to a lot of people because of the intergenerational being here for so many, you know, decades. You know, it wasn't unusual to have like 11 to 15 kids. And then obviously they go off and marry different people.
I don't even know. You know, I don't know. I meet people with like 4 or 5 kids and I'm like, I don't know how you do that.
No, no. I'm glad I'm done.
Yeah, and I bet you've seen, you know about, so even before all this, I mean, Oregon is historically a racist state. They didn't want to follow the Civil Rights Act. It's a breeding ground for KKK. It's a breeding ground for alt-right groups. And then, you know, we have the whole history of Albina and the hospital. We have the Vanport issue. I guess sort of my question for you is like, knowing the history of things, does that make you more angry or more excited to keep going? I mean, you got to sort of ask yourself, like, why do we keep going in circles, I guess?
Yeah, it's pretty much a work ethic, right? It's like, I don't want the work of the people that came before me to be in vain. I don't want the death or the disclusion or any of the harm of oppression that we're facing. I don't want the people who, you know, who don't deserve to be treated that way. I don't want any effort to be in vain. So I'm just trying to do my little part, you know, in the time that I'm allowed on planet Earth. And so it's just, that's just it. I know my family's history. I know so much because I grew up, you know, listening to my grandparents And, you know, a lot of what I'm learning right now about going back in archives and reading up on local history and things of that sort, I got initiated because I found my great-grandmother's scrapbook. And I was like, whoa, this is interesting. And I saw all these different opportunities that Black people had in Portland. And it was really, it was during the war. So, you know, during those times, you know, they would recruit the Black community to be the policing, or, you know, the, you know, all the different communities based on their ethnicity. They served an industry in the city of Portland as far as like a bureau for the city. And so in its management. And so seeing that and seeing how people were able to kind of sufficiently take care of their children, having nice homes, having their kids go into these really good schools in these really good neighborhoods, but not having the ability to kind of own that property and also having to have, like, you know, it seemed odd to me that we weren't past that. It was like, oh, okay, now we can buy homes, but people still get to mandate where you get to buy that home and how you're treated in those communities. And it's not so far-fetched to say that at this point we're even further behind than we were then. And the only reason that we had any kind of benefit was because there was no one to compete with for opportunities. And it shouldn't be an opportunity competition. It should be qualifications, right? And we don't see that. In my organizing and my protesting, I'm always researching and kind of like auditing the way policies are holding us in an oppressive state. And it's because of that austerity, right? It's because, like, no, this is how we do it. But it's like, wait, at what point do we realize that we're upholding and mandating white supremacist policy, right? And creating the struggle and the harm and the violence against the people. So it's just...
Well, and that's a good point that, you know, racism is codified in both laws and institutions. And so, you know, like what you were talking about, you know, not just with redlining, but people still can't access loans to get houses. You know, we have the prison industrial complex where if you're Black, you get thrown in jail, you get the book thrown at you, as they say. I mean, it just goes on and on. So I guess my question for you is, like, do you think that this time is different? Do you see that there's progress? Is that why you still keep fighting for it? How do you sort of not get exhausted? Be like, I'm done.
No, I don't see progress at all. Okay. Sadly, because I do, you know, hang out in the archives and research how things managed to even give us a voice, and the management of getting access. That struggle has changed because obviously we can heighten awareness of our voices and the things that are happening. Through social media, through different mediums, rather than, you know, the lack of communication systems they had back in the day. Like, you know, they would have to send out these Western Union messages. They would have to go to church and, you know, congregate in different groups. And so you had these networks of people that would share information, and that's how work was done. At our present time, we're able to build community around these issues, and we're able to use that same building system to kind of educate people and do call to actions. And so I think that just our ability to communicate the issues is broader, but I don't see that there's any progress. You literally had over 70 million people voting for a white supremacist. We watched the, you know, the initiation of suppression at the Capitol on January 6th. I mean, it is what it is. We're watching right now the George Floyd trial, where they're basically showing, like, hey, the mandate of these policies and directives allow for the murder of this person. Like, we're following protocol. And it's like, I know, but we all know that those protocols are built out of slavery. So unless we, like, indict the system and abolish it, we're not getting anywhere. No reform is going to fix what we're currently suffering from, which is terrorism.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you can dice racism in multiple ways, but it's still there. You know, there are people who say that they hire everybody, but then they code the applications. There are people who say, you know, we don't have a problem with someone like that living in our neighborhood. Then that person moves there and they're discriminatory against them. Mm-hmm. It's everywhere. But I'm shocked that it had to take, I mean, even people like George Floyd, you know, people say, well, we recognize that he had a mother and he was calling out for his mother and he couldn't breathe. And So people of all races, like, they sort of, they said that, oh, well, we feel for him or whatever. Like, but what about Tamir Rice? What about, you know, Michael Brown? I sort of, like, I don't understand, like, where were you before or why are you, it's great that George Floyd has a movement. It's great that everybody has a movement, right? But where were you with Trayvon Martin? Where were you? Like, where were you with, where were you with all these other people? So that's sort of disheartening. So how do you think that happens? Like,
I think that people that were bystanders that were pretty much like watching and witnessing what's been happening over the last 10 years, that they basically knew that because of the experience of being quarantined, because of what we didn't trust about Donald Trump and the administration in regards to how we were being treated because of COVID-19, I think that those certain circumstances during that time helped initiated their force of engagement, right? I think that there were so many inequities on top of inequities that were being illuminated through media and online that people were sharing, that people were experiencing their own basic understanding of those inequities, right? And so when the call to action happened, it happened and people showed up that intentionally and unconsciously wanted change, but I think inherently they were looking for something to kind of substitute that loneliness, that defensiveness that they had. I think they wanted to be stronger and they wanted to be bolder because we were feeling discouraged and hopeless sitting in our homes. And I think that's just a human response. Like, you know, we're showing up for George Floyd, but I'm showing up for myself too. I'm showing up for my community. I'm showing up for everybody. And then you also have like the propaganda machine of like all these political parties and their allies and how they need to benefit financially and, you know, pretty much network social equity from these uprisings and how they're able to manipulate and organize when they happen. To their benefit. And so the political infrastructure, the necessity of the 2020 vote, all of those different things that usually would be disregarding someone's life and would not use their machines to illuminate inequities and would not use their machines and their resources and partnerships to support voices of vulnerable, at-risk, marginalized, systemically abused people. They had no other opportunity. That was the propaganda that was in place.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. So, you know, there's a right to protest. And there was this sort of thing where everybody in the country, like even Donald Trump, I call him Don the Con, you know, was talking about Portland. Like, Portland's on fire and Portland's violent and it's the liberal left mob. And but really the violence was primarily police. And it was tear gas, and it was beating people and rubber bullets, and I mean, on and on and on, throwing people in vans. And so I guess my question for you is, why did it, I mean, maybe you don't know this, but why did it become that way? Is it because it's always been that way? Is it because people use the story for their own good? They want to retell it, which is probably what white America does, is they sort of retell the history of
right. You have to know, like, Portland is the whitest city in America and is very bold in its bias against Black people, and anti-Blackness centers everyone's voices at that point, right? They can use anti-Blackness to build platforms for whatever their cause is and say that it's based on equity or, you know, bringing awareness to disparities. And as somebody that's lost a loved one that I know, a lot of people don't even know his name, watching the centering of George Floyd's death, watching the profiles become BLM, Black Lives Matter, and knowing that those contusions of people have never really shown up for their own neighbors in their own communities, and witnessing that. And like I told you, I research audits. You know, I'm looking for information of engagement. But really seeing all of that transpire, it hurt. I had to, like, the only focus that I had in regards to the protest was protecting people's right to expression. But what I saw significantly, it hurt me because I watched white people, like majority privileged people, turn Black Lives Matter into some type of fundraiser. And in all the years that I protested, you'll never see where I'm fundraising because I'm out there showing up for my community in any kind of way, right? I wouldn't do that. Like, we literally were surviving off of $10,000 to $27,000 a year on just donations coming from people because we weren't even engaging. And, like, investing the time to build up grants because we wanted to keep our work and the support that we provide our community anonymous so that they could have pride and value because it's not supposed to be charity. It's a mutual aid. So seeing that happen, and then recently hearing from, you know, Samaria Rice, who I was on the panel with in December, I hope that people are looking at that. Like, you're not supposed to profit from Black death. Even if you show up at your benefit, if it helps the movement, but not if it just helps you stay consistently there. We don't need you there if you're only there because we can buy you new tools and new gear. Like, we literally had an office filled with donated materials for anyone who needed them, and we're on task as a Black-led organization supporting that movement in Minneapolis by making sure the movement here was resourceful. And people would still be like, no, we're going to do our own thing. And it was like, wow, like, in our face, like, you don't really care about Black lives. Support, sustain Black infrastructure, even when it becomes, you know, a response to trauma. We were able, through our mutual aid efforts, able to support communities throughout the country and lawsuits for hundreds of people. And so, I mean, supporting us makes it sustainable because we're not going to wait for George Floyd to die or another George Floyd to die, or for the next pandemic to show up. We need to continually do this as we have been, you know? It just was like, wow, I never knew you can get a platform that big, that fast, even though we've been out there getting hit by cars and beat up and spit on and, you know, standing up against white supremacists that killed, like, Larnell Bruce and the people on the MAX train that same week that, you know, George Floyd was murdered. We sentenced the, you know, Jeremy Christian to, you know, triple life sentence, but I don't remember anybody being at the trial for the 4 weeks. You know, people wouldn't even share information that was being posted about it. So it's just odd that same.
Or they don't know about his behavior prior to that.
Huh?
I said a lot of people don't know about his behavior prior to the stabbing situation.
They didn't know about his behavior?
Yeah, a lot of people didn't.
No, there was a whole movement of anti-racism against white supremacists and encouraging the Proud Boys after he committed the murders, because I remember the Proud Boys coming up to our movements all the time with their 2, 3, 4 little couple of people in their signs. And I'd just be like, don't engage, don't give them a platform. But when our allies, our comrades said, hey, we're going to give them a platform because we're going to counter them, or however that consciousness works for them, it gave them a platform. You know what I'm saying? Like, everybody knew about Jeremy Christian and the Proud Boys. I mean, the Proud Boys built a platform off of Jeremy's murderistic, work. Like, that's...
The thing that you mentioned about the Capitol riot and the president and all that, there's always been a normalization of hate, but even more so, there's a normalization of hate. And that's really sickening, because someone will say to you, you know, you're progressive, I'm a neo-Nazi, we're the same, we both have a point of view. And I go, hate or violence are not a point of view. That's not a valid...
Not at all.
So, but in their mind, they have their freedom of expression or their freedom of membership. So where that happened as a society, or where that has, like, repermeated is sick. It's a cancer society to think that these are groups that have a right to exist, that their existence is in violence and hate. I wanted to talk to you because you mentioned that a lot of people don't experience this or know what people have been through, and hopefully you're okay with me asking about your nephew Andre and you know, him being shot and how that inspired you. I know inspired by someone being shot is not the correct. But can you kind of talk to me about that? Like, you know, how, when your work through Don't Shoot and your community activism, how that relates back to this was your nephew who you lost. I mean, this was a person that you know.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that he wasn't the only person that was lost. And so by the time he was murdered downtown, To me, it was like, how is this unexplained? How are we a part of a group of community, a whole generation that has been stolen from us in gun violence? How do we have all these mandates and all of these policies and all these opportunities and operations that are sanctioned within our community, focused mostly in Multnomah County, where the Black population resides? How do we have all of this commerce coming into this community because of this issue with no resolution, with no investment, with no solutions? Like, how do we lose our children and not ask questions? Because one of the things that had occurred to me before my nephew died was that, you know, I was working with Barbara Wheeler and other people in Multnomah County at District 2 as a community volunteer to kind of like build up, you know, opportunities for them to offset the gun violence that was happening. And when I went to the meeting, you know, I was really just visiting Portland. But when I went to the meeting and I heard like what their ideas were, like, oh, we're going to buy the, you know, the gang members' diapers, or we're going to visit them in jail, or we're going to help pay for some bills, and we're going to have like a talent show and a festival. Like, when they were saying stuff like that around the centering of violent murders, I didn't understand how those things connected. I was like, whoa, why aren't we like systemically using all of the power in this room to kind of violate and dismantle the issues around the root causes? Why aren't we like providing more housing, providing more food, providing more planning for families that are being displaced? Why aren't we, you know, providing more resources to teachers who are not able to accommodate children that have issues or are vulnerable? Like, why are we policing those issues and then also working with the police and all these health agencies and education agencies and transportation agencies to kind of identify which kids are like the bad apples or would be red flags for violence? Like, if you see the violence, if you know inherently that is happening within this certain area, why aren't you transposing those issues? And you're the kind of the leaders. I had never been in a room full of leaders in my life. So being in this room with all these impactful voices and hearing them talk about, you know, buying diapers and having a festival for people and their families who are losing life and futures to gun violence, I thought that it was a critical misfortune for anyone involved and that we could do something about it. And so I was working with them to do something about it through the Black Women for Peace. Right when my nephew got murdered, I had gave them a plan that was worked out called the, not at the time, it wasn't the ADP Foundation, but it was called My City, My Soul. And it was a very complex strategy on how to engage within the community to kind of build investment within the community through building community traditions and values for, you know, cultural competency, because everybody was centering Blackness in their violation of liberty. And so doing that, they thought, oh, we can get a grant for this. And I was like, fuck, what are you talking about? Like, all of you, which it was like 70 different agencies and people in the room, I said, all of you already belong to organizations that should have a mission for social impact. And so why not, you know, redirect resources to this focus instead of looking for a grant, because grants are not a consistent and sustainable force. So and they thought that was crazy.
And this is like 10 years ago, right?
This is like almost 11 years ago now. Okay. But yeah, it's 10 years ago that was happening. And they were just like, whoa, you're tripping. Like, you know, we don't have to really, you know, like the response was, we really don't have to focus on these issues if we promote awareness about them. And if we build, you know, like data around them, then we can get more resources to do something. And I was like, you're already in a position to fucking do something. And then that weekend, my nephew got murdered. So I had a chip on my shoulder. I was like, wait a minute, no, are you kidding me? Like, my brother's baby just got killed and we live in Portland and these motherfuckers is about to exploit what just happened to him. I'm watching it happen as I'm sitting there with my brother and our family. I'm seeing it play out and I couldn't believe it. And I already thought, like, it's racketeering, because I had been sitting at the table hearing them discuss opportunities. Yeah. So just to me, it was like, no, let me go ahead and get more information and get engaged, because they're not going to use these children and continue to use our community to harm us. And especially not because, you know, my nephew died. And right after that, his cousin died. And right after that, my cousin killed himself. And then my godson killed himself. And so it was like consistent. I'm sorry. But it never stopped.
Don't ever be sorry. I mean, these are real experiences and
all that shit within 6 months. Okay, come on. No, and it hasn't stopped. So there was nobody and still is no one literally responding to those issues. They
diapers and a party are not going to cut it, right? Like, it doesn't do anything for you. Part of this problem is it that people try to prescribe solutions instead of just like asking them what they need or actually finding out from them directly. You presented a whole plan. So it's like, instead, let us tell you what you need instead of asking you to be part of the solution.
When I say something is racketeering, I mean, like, from the standpoint of, I worked for a CPA for 15 years. In my opinion, when you have agency based on nepotism or cronyism, and the whole focus of the agency is to keep funding coming in, but no one's actually qualified to provide the resource of service, but you're always on the front line because everyone approves your involvement. Even at critical stages where you have over 200 unsolved homicides and families being displaced and erratic numbers in audits like the MacArthur Red Foundation, there's still no focus of oversight or accountability. That, to me, is a measure of criminal neglect. It's literally like, no, our partnerships are going to go after this funding and we're going to be supported by these politicians and we're, you know, wanted in these communities because we're the only ones getting these resources. And so people are desperate. And then at the same time, when we talk about like the machine propaganda or whatever, if you're centered to be the leader, then yeah, obviously I can make you out to be whatever. But I don't have to hold you accountable for any outcomes. And in our community, there is no one being held accountable for outcomes. So when we talk about public safety and gun violence, no one's on board with a solution at all, because the solutions mean financial impact in families that are criminalized for being in poverty. Because the only way out of poverty, if you're hungry, is getting food, however you got to get the food. You know, if you are suffering from being illiterate because people are biased in our education system, like Portland Public Schools has no Black teachers. I think there might be like one or two in the school district. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, you have a whole lot of strenuous trauma that's being directed at one demographic, and there's financial benefit in being a participant in that, but there is no obligation for any kind of outcome or accountability for any kind. I mean, like, when I came home and I looked at how things were being managed, we were literally delivering certifications and awards to people just for having jobs, so that we could use that new part of that resume to kind of get more funding for other opportunities. I mean, when you're getting audited by the Center for Public Integrity and you get a D because there's no actual process in the way that you're handling, managing communities, that's our burden, the people that are most vulnerable, the people that are most risk.
So is part of the issue, I mean, there's a lot of issues, but...
Yeah, it's all systemic, if they pull that shit together.
So one of the issues is probably representation that... You know, it's sort of like, I'm white and privileged, but I would say I'm different than a lot of white people in that I care about our community as a whole, you know, full stop. But I think that there's a lot of people who it's sort of like they only have to deal with, they call it like Black issues when they have to deal with Black issues, or like they think it's some, you know, racism's not real, you know, like people like that. Or when they actually deal with it, it's sort of this like white saviorship of like, I'm going to do something good. And yes, it's going to be good for someone, but it's going to be good for me. And I'm going to become elevated. Like,
yeah.
I guess my question for you is like, how do you deal with knowing who's legitimately there for you to help you and who's not? Because I have a problem with that. I don't even know how you would figure that out. So, you know,
I started doing this thing called bystander intervention so that I could tell people to lay off and do the work themselves, because I'm not in a position to take anyone telling me anything. Like, I don't handled myself well with people misleading me. So, you know, the person that I am, I'm usually delegating work and really structuring it and being specific about how I want it. And I'll ask people like, hey, what are you good at? Or like, why are you here? And why do you want to volunteer? Like, what's your resume? And then I'll utilize the qualities. I'll talk to them and find out what they're good at. And I make that a part of how they work within our organization to support us, because I don't want it to be charity. You know what I'm saying? I need it to be natural so that we can actually have social change at some point. People get burned out when they're doing things for other people that's not a part of their intentional consciousness. So the way that I work with people is different. Like, we become like a liquid type of system. And I had to get there because of the violence in trying to help people process and kind of regulate how they showed up. Like, after the Max murders, when I started doing the bystander intervention training, there were people literally asking me, like, what should I do when I see a Black person in distress or being harmed or something like that? And I was like, you would do the same thing you would do if you saw an animal being in distress or being harmed or something. Like, you would care first, and then you would probably leap into action second, whether that action be to record it or to initiate or assert some type of civil or human directive. Like, you don't just stand there and say, wow, that's not my issue, or you keep moving, or you say that's a Black thing. The thing to me that qualifies someone to kind of like initiate support in a community is the actual intention. They don't have to be a Black person or a white ally or none of that shit. They got to be an intentional person that's really focused on like long-term goals for social change. And I think we all have space to learn what that looks like for ourselves in our lives. But I think that's where it becomes sustainable, you know? People that need your help aren't going to stop needing your help, you know?
yeah, absolutely. And that's a good point. And I don't know, I mean, if people are afraid to respond because they think they're going to have the wrong response. But that doesn't make sense to me, because someone needs help and someone needs help. You know, you do your best in the situation, but if you don't help them at all, like, you're not helping anybody. But, you know, I've been hearing a lot about mutual aid. We have some clients who are mutual aid organizations. Like, what can you tell me kind of like how you would define mutual aid, what it means to you?
To me, like, mutual aid is basically a common unity, right? It's something that we've always practiced, like, in our communities. My grandma and my mom, if you talk to them about growing up, they'll say, yeah, when I was growing up, you know, we had the lady on our block that would watch the kids, the other one who would do the laundry, the one who would, you know, like, her husband would go out to the farm and pick, you know, beans or whatever. But people share their resources in communities that were seen to have a disadvantage, right? And people still do that, but we do it through foundations. We do it through organizations. And my thought about mutual aid is that's something that if we're really intent on building social change in our communities, then we should be intent on developing ways to provide social aid into those communities through mutual aid services, whether it be like legal support or medical support or food support or, you know, managed, you know, housing, you know, assistance or things like that help kind of like remove the burden of our necessity to depend on the government system. Like, the government and the system that is constituted in is inherently racist. It is built on white supremacy. And when people go to these agencies for services, they are seen as a part of the tool, right? And the tool has to work. And so they are exploited, they're harmed. But what I've seen that with mutual aid, there is more abundance coming into our communities and less need for the government to respond to critical resources. We were, during the COVID outbreak, again, we were able to distribute tens of thousands of tons of resources to so many people. And through people donating to our organization, we were able to reallocate those funds to like legal services and to people's direct needs. And we didn't have to capture information about who those people were because we didn't want to. We didn't want to out people in our taxes or any kind of way to say, hey, you know, like, this person actually was in downtown Portland and was injured, or, you know, like, whatever they were doing to kind of freely express themselves, we wanted that freedom to be protected. And so through our agency, we provided resources to help them. And that was just in our ability to show up for mutual aid. It wasn't a systemic program or anything that we had instituted. It wasn't a grant. It was just like, oh, we have an abundance coming in. Let's reallocate where it's needed. And I think that that's where we should be as a society. There's nobody that should look at the homeless or the unhoused situation in Portland and think that the mandate is only on the city. I think that that's something that we all should be innovative in thinking about ways to kind of dismantle the problems around it, which is like safety. A woman was killed in her tent the other night by a person that was a known murderer who had just killed her boyfriend. And he was, you know, released back into that community to kill her and also to intimidate and harm other people. And me, as someone who is an activist that lives in activist circles, people don't want people to have guns and people don't want people to, you know, think living in a houseless tent camp is unsafe. But for the people that actually live there, it is. Yeah. And, you know, we don't want to create a circumstance where that is the foundation and we want it to be sustained. No, we want their needs to be addressed. And when you build mutual aid, if you're able to provide more resources to help build sustainable and really dismantle some of the poverty that we're seeing, that's when you're making real big impact. You know, me dropping off supplies to the camp every week is not as impactful as trying to procure a big old apartment building and rehabilitating it while providing educational opportunities to the people learning how to build on the building and then using it to house people that want to transition into housing. Even before COVID, we had children that had been displaced through foster care and overwhelmingly from the Black community, living in hotels and on the street and in police stations and behind cars because there wasn't adequate space for them to house all the kids in foster care. And there's so many people applying to be foster parents that weren't actually, you know, qualified. And so, again, when we talk about mutual aid, I think we're just on the beginning of what that looks like. I think people can become bigger givers through more innovative thoughts on how to offset what is creating a circumstance for punishment for being, you know, a minority in this country.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, I think mutual aid is great. And I like what you said about the, I read that story too. I thought that was horrible about the woman murdered and her boyfriend being murdered. And, you know, why that guy was released, who knows? We'll have to find that out. But you're absolutely right. I mean, people who are, whether someone lives in a tent or a castle, they're still a neighbor, they're still part of the community. That could be you one day. And the other thing I think about is, so we're all about paperwork. I mean, I'm an attorney, so we're all about like paperwork and things like that. But, you know, if there's extra food being thrown out by a hotel and because that organization couldn't get a food permit to give it to the homeless, and they have that issue downtown, you know, like they had to stop giving out soup to people. Mm-hmm. We're missing the mark, right? Like,
yeah,
we could do liability waivers, we could do this, we could do that. But like, someone's starving, or someone needs childcare, or someone needs, you know, whatever it is, socks.
Whatever. I think what the next stage should be building credit and, you know, procuring property and things like that so that we can do more as a community. I think when I watched fundraising happening during George Floyd's murder, and while we were all still experiencing and processing it, I thought about like, wow, so y'all been letting us suffer this long for, you know, no real reason. I couldn't believe how many people were giving during a fucking pandemic. You know, and it just occurred to me that there have been times when we were healthier as a nation where people could have been giving in this same kind of sustainable way because of these, you know, like when you talk about people showing up, like that was the part that drove me nuts. I didn't know how to feel about it.
You're absolutely right. It shouldn't have to take, you know, a Breonna Taylor, George Floyd type of movement for people to give food to their hungry neighbor. You know, or to ask them how they're doing. I mean, it's, this should just be part of being a human being and having decency and being part of a community.
Well, that's why earlier I said it had something to do with people's personal benefit. Like, I think that people felt like they had to show up, you know, when those protests happened, because there were valid reasons that they should intersect with the inequities. But it has to continue. It can't be, I'm going to put my shirt up and, you know, put my pictures of me out there in frames and throw them on the wall and call it a day. No.
Or this sounds horrible, but they wait for the next Black person to be killed.
No, please don't.
Instead of being decent, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
unfair. It's not entertainment. And that's what's shady about it, is that to people, it becomes that. And we're so numb as a society because of how we, you know, produce media and images of Black people, that we do consume it. We are consuming it, and it is not okay.
Yeah, and I've talked to people too who they don't get. So it's there are people who are not yet there, but they're on the path. Like they're working on their issues. So I'm a little bit more forgiving, but there are people who will tell me like, well, I don't really believe that this happens or that happens. And so there's that conversation of like, you know, I don't know what it is to be Black, so I'm not Black. But the fact that like you go into a Walgreens, if you're African American, someone follows you, they think you're going to steal. You drive, you go into your neighbor's house because you're feeding their dog because they're on vacation. You're worried about getting shot because they think you're breaking in. Like literally every single thing that you do. And we saw that, and we saw it on the news. Girl sleeping in her, lady sleeping in her dorm room, you know, the police, they call the police on her. You know, like every single thing you do, it's like living while being Black.
And imagine how heavy that is every single day. Like, I prefer COVID life. Like, when COVID struck and people were quarantined, and then when we were outside, we knew we couldn't be in each other's way. I was so free. I've never felt that liberated in my life. I was like, oh my God, nobody's looking at me. Nobody's like, the terror of having white authority in every white person, that being removed, because that is an obstacle that exists within a whole social behavior. When we talk about like whiteness and privilege, I don't think that people realize the focus they had on Black life and how we, you know, participate in society. And I think, again, we have to reckon with the time that we've had to process what's been going on and how we became who we are, and how we dismantle that. But that was a real situation. Like, I'm noticing that post COVID, or, you know, since I'm back in society and a kind of, you know, I go out maybe 3 times a week, that it's less than it was before COVID. But before COVID, it was literally painful to walk down the street, to go anywhere. Like, people had time to call you a nigga. You know what I'm saying? People had time to treat you disrespectful, and they had the priority and privilege to do it. With COVID, there was masks. There was very little tolerance around engagement, you know? So that changed for a lot of people, and it's a trip.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's sort of like, I would say I'm sorry. I it's like, I can't give you words to tell you how disgusted and baffled that people still believe that this is okay. This is an okay way to act. And then, like you said, people are complicit with it. 70 million people, you know, are complicit with that behavior. But what I wanted to talk to you about is, you know, there's this sort of like kumbaya. We have a Black vice president, and you know, we now have a diverse cabinet, but we can't fall into this, what they call toxic positivity, right? Like, all the issues, they actually have to be dealt with, and they're going to hurt. And we're going to talk about 400 years of oppression. And we're going to talk about how, like, there are still lynchings in America, you know, like, so like, how do you deal? Okay. So this is the issue I have, is that, people, when it gets deep, they walk away. Everybody wants like surface level. They're like, they don't want to like actually feel the pain or actually hear what a Black person goes through, because that's too hard for them. And I cry me river, right? Like, how do we like get to a deeper conversation instead of this, like, oh, we've had tough times, everybody's happy now? Because I think that's just destructive. That just kind of repeats the cycle over and over again.
Well, that's white privilege in itself, is that amnesia, right? Selective amnesia, like, oh no, Donald Trump made America racist. We were protesting when Barack Obama was the president. You know what I'm saying? Like, my grandparents protested. The great grand, like, people have been in bondage in this country on stolen land since the inception of the country. So there's no way that we feel like, you know, as a society, as a civil or civilized or whatever, as a civil society, that we should think that our futures are going to be inherently unblemished and that we can go back to happy days because of the leaders, because the foundation of the infrastructure of the entity is based on white supremacy and the diminishment of humanity of so many of the people that live here. And as we encourage our government systems to be more efficient and to be reformed, we're just literally, in my opinion, clearing the way for those things to be more effective in their use. I think with Donald Trump, like, he just literally elevated the use of obstacles that we face, and he elevated the use of creating barriers between resources, but he didn't make the system that allows it, and we live within that system. So, I mean, you can't just be like, oh, yeah, President Biden's the president. He's a white supremacist. He's a white dude that literally had to go in there and run for president because the other white dude who don't like black people and steals and, you know, gropes women, is just so undesirable for us to show as the president. Like, we as a country can admittedly say, like, for propaganda use, we chose Joe Biden because he looked more presidential than the brown people or the women or anybody else on the panel. And then we picked a brown woman because we knew that the motivation of all those people showing up for protest, which, you know, happened and created an opportunity for someone to show up in a leadership role, which he did, I guess, obviously, he's the president. But I mean, it's, to me, it's all propaganda at this point, because it's all built on whatever we build as a narrative and whatever we propagate. But the fact of the matter is that there's so many people engaged and involved that they know the truth. And so when we talk about give the land back, when we talk about abolishing the police, when we talk about, you know, dismantling a broken system, it's not to repair it and create elevation for it to work better or to assimilate an entire generation into understanding that it takes time to make these things better. Bureaucracy sucks. Break the system. Fuck the police. Like, we have to tear all that shit down. I'm sorry. Like, that, it literally has to be dismantled, and we have to do it in intrinsically focused on taking out the measure of hierarchy and white supremacy.
Well, that's it.
Allows for violence.
Well, that's a good transition, because I wanted to ask you about that, because the moment that you talk about that, right, whether it's defund the police or break down the system, people go, oh, well, you can't do that, and it's going to be anarchy. And like, people sort of misinterpret. They don't know that you're not saying that you don't think that there should be police, or there shouldn't be a city council, or, you know, like, what you're trying to say is, like, the institution is so damaged and cancerous that it has to entirely be rebuilt. Mm-hmm. So, and also, you know, with policing, like, why do police need military grade weapons, and why, you know, why is there no oversight? Why is there no accountability? So I guess, how did you deal with that? Like, when the whole defund the police movement came about, you know, did you have a response for people that were like, what do you mean defund the police? You can't do that.
But we never did Reconstruction after emancipation. Like, Black people started getting lynched, and we created all these patrols. So we even gave insurance to people who lost property because they couldn't commodify Black bodies anymore. We allowed systems to harm people in this country based on commodifying Black bodies, Black Americans' bodies. Not everybody was treated that way. And so if you're for allowing it, then that means you're benefiting from it. And that's where we have anti-Blackness. Like, all I can say is that if the things that are happening in our community were happening to people that live in, like, the Northwest Hills or Southwest Portland or something like that, if it was happening to their children, it would not be allowed. It would be an atrocity. Yeah. There would be human rights issues around it. It would be lawsuits. But we're doing it, and we don't even investigate the murders. And we criminalize the parents of people in Black communities who suffer from gun violence or police brutality or systemic neglect. It's just unheard of, you know, like, come on, we have the numbers. it's not just about people assuming that Dr. King must be crazy and radical because he wants people to go to the same restaurants or the kids to go to the same schools or living in housing that's decent. We know that those are basic benefits for humans in America. We said that in like our constitution is supposed to be allowed.
Yeah.
Those things don't exist.
We also have the 13th.
Just tell them to do their research.
Well, we also have the 13th Amendment, which is anti-slavery, anti-indentured servant, but yet we still treat Black people like that. So
absolutely. I mean, we're not being paid equal wages. So what do we call that when you can do the same amount of work? Or really, everybody knows that we rely on Black people's labor, whether it's to share, inform, educate, or do the labor. But they can't even afford to take care of their kids.
Or build the White House or the Capitol.
Huh?
I said, or to build the White House or the Capitol.
You know, come on. So, I mean, if we're so dependent on it, why aren't we making those wages that could ensure our children's futures, that can make sure that we don't have that additional stress of, oh my God, there's not any food in the refrigerator, and should I pay these bills or buy some groceries? Like, I don't, you know, not to say that all Black Americans are poor right now, but come on, does it take over 400 years for us to have at least 1 or 2% of the population living in a situation where they can have savings?
Sure, yeah. Or like what you were talking about, resource-wise, we have the resources. We're throwing away food, millions and millions of pounds of food a day.
Exactly. So
I have a couple more questions, and then I have my 5 questions I ask every guest. But what I wanted to ask you before those 5 questions was, I wanted to ask you about your political life. So I know you ran for commissioner and ran for mayor, and then you had a write-in mayoral campaign. Can you kind of just talk to me about that? Like, what inspired you to run for politics? I know that's a lot to cover in a short amount of time. What did you think about people writing you in as a mayoral candidate?
Well, the thing that inspired me to involve myself in politics was basically seeking information. I do a lot of research. I'm very interested in getting information and being able to kind of like interrogate, investigate, or whatever I need to do to find ways to dismantle our broken system. So participating in agency where you can be included in government access, that gives you a broad access point into all these different variables, right? You get to talk to different political leaders. You're invited to different forums where they're invited, so you get to see who their partners are. You're kind of presented information that they're presented, so you can even evaluate if they're efficient. Like, oh, shit, is this what they're dealing with? And these motherfuckers can't really take care of the city? Like, I mean, you know, I basically say, oh, okay, let me engage in this process so I can see how hard it is, this rocket science here. And so I did that, and like in the process was able to build a foundation of credibility and connections that help move the work that I'm doing further along to engage with my community, right? So having all these new relationships through the partnering of, you know, building the political committee and engaging in the political forums, that helped me do more in my community in regards to resource allocation and building agency as a public servant or advocate. And, you know, like people see that and they're like, let me call Tressa if I need a lawyer, you know, and you got people like Onisha Cochran, who literally her and Lontel and, you know, the women from the Diane Wade House sat in our office. We pulled together a whole campaign for how they were going to speak out, and they just won in their settlement. Just being able to advocate for people on a bigger level because of that platform that it allows you to have. When I had the, you know, and just imagine like this last year in 2020, I would have been elected as the mayor on Malcolm X's birthday. And all I kept thinking that whole week was that the Black woman is the least respected person in America. And so I knew it wasn't going to happen. And really, because we have been doing COVID response work since March, I felt that I wasn't in a position because of COVID quarantine and being a Black woman to become the mayor, because our city is extremely racist, and I don't think that they feel like they can rely on a Black person to provide resources that they really need. After George Floyd's death, and because of mutual aid and because of our resourcefulness in organizing community around the protests, obviously people were like, oh my God, the only persons that we can count on are like, Don't Shoot Portland and Tressa Rayford. And I saw the write-in campaign happen. And at the time of a protest, having a political foundation for me as an individual, it was a lot. It was extremely scary. I had anxiety. I was afraid for my life. You know, I'm pulling together lawsuits and trying to organize community because the direct issue that's happening is so important. And at the same time, I'm seeing my face all over the community, and I'm seeing like the staging of engagement at the protests, which is something I'm always yelling about, like, don't let them come over here with the political signs. Like, I've literally turned out panels because I've seen political signage, and I just don't want people to feel one way or another when we're trying to build community, because I don't rely on the system. I don't think we should. And so, like, it was just hard because it was like, dang, our community really needs a leader right now, and nobody's showing up. And instead of trying to write me in, we could be doing more mutual aid, you know. And I saw that kind of connect and become a mutual aid process as well. But it was, you know, I was encouraged because people really showed who they were. And at the time that I was running, I didn't see people that wanted anything to do with people that they seen, you know, like they had bias against. And they can say that they didn't have bias or whatever, but in looking for qualifications, I think that Portland would have done great with Ms. Rose as the mayor.
Yeah, and I can understand. I didn't even think about that you felt like you were more in danger, but that makes sense.
Yeah, it's scary.
So it sounds like you were, you know, happy about it in the sense that people recognized the work you were doing and realized that if anything...
I wasn't happy. I felt like, I mean, I love the people that did it, and I love that our community did that, but again, it was an obstacle for me for safety. I couldn't be as engaged in protests as I wanted to be. I was scared for my family. I was scared for my life because I'm organizing. I'm doing shit to help keep people safe. I'm filing lawsuits against Chad Wolf. I'm trying to respond to all these shootings in our community. And my face is out there. So you got white supremacists that don't want you, you know, in the community organizing. You have police that hate you because you suing them in several different lawsuits. And then you have people that are harming people in the community that don't want you outing them, and people that will support them in, you know, keeping safe, even though they harm other people. So I'm looking at all my obstacles and thinking, if something happens right now, it's going to be a whodunit. It's not going to be dry and clear. It's going to be like, oh, yeah, the gang members killed her, or, oh, it was a white supremacist attack and we don't know who they are, or whatever. I just felt like that was deadly. Like, that was, for me, it was extremely, it's still deadly. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's bad.
That too, is that that political campaign that you weren't really part of or didn't really ask for, you're right.
Safe.
What's that?
I said, I wanted to be safe like everybody else. I wanted to have my mask on and be anonymous. I didn't want people to be like, oh, Ms. Rayford, you know, and that wasn't what was happening. It was people knew who I was when I went places. Yeah. And that was very scary because I had been quarantined like everybody else, you know, like maybe COVID made it worse, but it was scary. It wasn't anything I was happy about.
Do you see yourself running again at some point, or is that sort of to be decided?
Huh?
Have you thought about running again for something, or is that like when the time comes?
I like planning ahead, and I haven't planned to run. I don't think Portland is ready for liberation. And it's not like I'm going to go in and say, hey, we don't do things this way anymore. But people know that we have to make fairness available in process and policy. And I don't think people care about what that looks like, because it doesn't benefit everybody for us to be fair. Like, people benefit from the process of white supremacy. And I think it's very scary to think about other people having more to where maybe I have less, or, you know, like, I think those interconnected biases exist. And we've used them for so long as a society that I would be wasting my time.
So it's kind of like the thing is that you want that Portland needs. Portland would think, would look back at that and say, that's too much for us.
Yeah. Yep. They were like, no, not right now. How about Joanne? How about so-and-so? That's our queen. You know, like someone that you can tell what to do, someone who's going to represent you and shut us up.
You know? I have respect for you. I have respect for Joanne. You're two different
people. I know.
People doing two different things. But I like to think, I mean, that the...
I'm going to say this. When I say Joanne, I'm just saying that in Portland politics, outside of Mr. Bogle, we don't elect Black people from Portland to office. You have to be a Black person from somewhere else. And you have to be supported by the status quo. You don't get to just parlay your butt in there. Joanne has support from the status quo and people that benefit from being bystanders. When they want to be, and she also has support from people that were committed to anti-racism. And so, you know, the burden of liberation is when we see a born and raised Portlander that actually understands the system and doesn't benefit from it. And it doesn't have to be me. There's several qualified applicants that would never do it because of the humiliation involved in it, just because of the Black. They're not feeling humiliated because they're less qualified. It's actually very humiliating to be treated a certain way in Portland when you're trying to stand up for your community. You lose that value.
Well, and that's unfortunate because we need that representation. But I understand the...
No one deserves that abuse.
I understand the sacrifice it would take, but then I'm also just hoping that there are people who take that leap so that we have more diversity in leadership.
Yeah, I think it's the people that have the majority of the ability to do that. I think just like how those kids did the write-in campaign and were able to get, 40,000 plus voters to write the name on their ballot, I think that people with more access should start organizing what that looks like so that it could happen, because I think we actually know how to manage and make things happen when we really want them to happen. But we depend on the vulnerable people to do the work for all of us. Like, hey, won't you just figure out a way to make it happen? Nah, you know what? If a group of people come to me and they're really set and that shit looks right, I already know we can win. But when I've run for office, and even with the write-in, those were individuals. Those weren't a group of people that were like, we're going to help change Portland and we're going to elect somebody that's, a radical leader, like what Nikita Oliver has in Seattle. And, it was people sitting on the sideline like, well, let me see. Well, did she do that? Or, it's funny. Portland is weird. But I document everything. So that's why my perception of it is all, kind of different, because I'm like looking at it in real time and documenting it. And it's like, wow, come on, let's be better.
Yeah, well, I appreciate and respect you, and I think you're making, I know it sounds cheesy, but you're making the world a better place, so I hope you keep that up. So I have five more questions. There are these short questions that I ask all the guests. So the first one is, if this wasn't your focus right now, so if Don't Shoot Portland wasn't your focus, what would be your passion project?
Art. I think art, and really, I was really into accounting. I really like building businesses and helping people find value in the work that they do. Like right now, because we have the ability, like we've never been in the situation that we're in right now. And all I can think about is publishing our work and making it available to different communities. And I'm talking about like art and education, history, STEM focused materials that are built and based on like just activism work. Before I moved to Portland, when I lived in Texas, I worked with a CPA, and he basically had bookkeepers and people like that. But I managed doing business development with different artists and different people in the entertainment industry, and watching them build platforms for human rights because they had this abundance of resource to kind of re-envelope into their communities. Building what that infrastructure looks like from an artistic angle. Shoot, that's all I've ever wanted to do. Like right now, Don't Shoot Portland being an arts organization, arts and education, people are always looking at it like, oh, so what are you doing? I'm like, arts and education. They're like, all of this is art and education. I'm like, yeah, it really is. We're committed to building artistic campaigns to communicate and to express ourselves. And however that looks with art, you can't control it. So it gets to change and modify and evolve as it needs to. And for the work that I'm doing, it's for social change. Art is the only element, you know, or like tool that I have access to that people won't criminalize.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, I also think people need art now more than ever.
Yeah.
What's something in your life other than your given or chosen family that you know will always bring you joy?
The earth. I mean, I'm an outside person. And I grew up with my family, but also in foster care. And one of the things that I really love about Portland and love about like my environment is the ability to be able to go outside and feel peace and to feel like love and joy in that environment. And as somebody that, you know, I reached my 50th birthday this past year, throughout my life, regardless of who was there, whether it was my children or my parents or, you know, somebody that was a mentor to me, I've always seen myself when I have memories being close to nature, sitting in grass, being under a tree, you know, hanging out on a back porch. And everybody knows me for that. They're like, I can't believe you're out there at these protests. You used to be somewhere with your notebook and a pencil sitting up under a tree. And I'm like, I know, because I feel good when I'm in nature. It could be raining and I'll just have on rain boots and, you know, and something up under me just so I can be out there listening to the rain. While I'm out there, but that's what gives me joy and peace is just nature.
Nice. What are you binge watching or reading right now?
Oh, shoot. let me see. I'm binge watching the Chauvin trial, actually. Yeah. And so I haven't been able to read anything. I just got the new Kendi book, him and Keisha Blaine. Their book about the 1619 to 2019. I got a couple of copies, but I haven't even looked in it. I haven't looked in a new For Real book that I have. I haven't really read Black Futures, and I have that. But Stamped is like one of my favorite books because it was so... it was so visionary. It was like it gives you a visual concept of what's happening to Black people in America. In a way that wasn't just, you know, like an idea. He had facts, receipts, as we call them. So that's one of my favorite books. That and, yeah, The Chauvin Trial is my binge watch.
Yeah. First of all, I didn't know there was a Pharrell book out. That's interesting.
A what?
You said Pharrell has a book out?
Yeah. Places I've seen. I just gave it out to people that participated in our spring breakout.
Nice. I don't know. Pharrell still looks like he's 16. I don't know how that happens.
Black.
When the world gets back to normal or whatever you want to call it, post-pandemic, where would you like to travel to?
First of all, I hope it doesn't get back to normal. I hope we have a different type of response to each other. And I just want to get to a beach in warm weather without any smoke. Like living in Portland and, you know, we had to deal with the wildfires, COVID, the shutdowns and everything. Yeah. And then when it was okay to go to the beach again, it was so cold. And I just want to go to a beach with sand and warm weather. And I don't care where it is, if it's, you know, an hour away at the coast or if it's somewhere down south. Which I'm scared to go down south because they too many anti-maskers. But yeah, that's where I want to go. I just want to be in some sand and I just want to be able to hang out in the sun.
Nice. Yeah, that sounds nice. If you were to give a TED talk, I don't know, maybe you have so far, I don't know. But if you were to give a TED talk, what would you share? What would you talk about?
I did a TED talk in 2017, right before I had a surgery. And right before Donald Trump was inaugurated, and I talked about Nazism and the imploding inauguration of Donald Trump. And then following that, I did a Not My President's Day on February 22nd, I believe it was, raising the name of Qantas Hayes. In the TED Talk, not only did I talk about Nazism and the fact that the Obamas were exiting the White House, but I also talked about the work that we do as Don't Shoot Portland and the work that inspired that and kind of gave a blueprint because I was hoping that people that were community organizers and people that wanted to participate in social justice movements would look at it and say, oh, those are some things I could do. So it was kind of a practical layout on what to do to fight racism.
Very cool.
In your community.
And then the last thing is, one, how can people find you if they want to get involved? And then also, give us some shout outs to organizations or companies that you think are doing a good job and you want to tell them that.
Oh, heck yeah. Shoot, then you're going to ask me without Ty being here. well, let me see. What was the first question again? Because I started thinking about companies as soon as you...
Oh, yeah, no, you're fine. So the first one is just like, say someone wants to be involved with Don't Shoot Portland. What do they do or how should they get involved?
Well, right now, the way to get involved is to go to don'tshootpdx.org and check out our work and see if it's something you actually want to be involved in. And then the second thing is that we just started some committees, which I've been trying to get a board that would work with me on developing committees. And what that looks like is having outreach partners that meet once a month on the line to talk about things that are practical for us to be involved in. We have a legal committee, we have a community outreach committee, and we're building a finance committee right now. And so all those committees will come in place to help build sustainability for the work that we do, but also help us build efficient models for engaging, because we are still dealing with a pandemic. And I've seen some efficiencies in the work that we've done to mobilize during the pandemic. So we want to kind of create structure based on those efficiencies so that we can keep doing this work even when everybody's not involved in it. And so the second one was shout outs to, first of all, every youth that has ever participated in our programming or come to a protest, because this year so many kids that showed up not only to the summer programs at, you know, for Juneteenth, but also through the write-in campaign and other different ways. And kids showing up and making their own protests in their own communities, contacting us and, you know, connecting with us on how to do that. I want to put a shout out to them, because people don't understand they carried the burden of that motivation that it took for us to build such a big mutual aid effort here in Portland and really across the country, because their efforts were seen on the front line in their own communities. And it took a lot of courage to, you know, show up and make a protest in your own community neighborhood. So I'll say out to the Children's Art and Social Justice Council, and we don't have any kind of hierarchy, so that's any youth that's involved in social change. I'll also put a shout out to all the different lawyers. Ashley Albies, this summer I contacted her because I couldn't breathe in my downtown apartment. And I was telling her that it was horrible that the police were able to assault us and what could we do about it. And because so many donors who, this is the shout out to all the donors, so many donors were donating to us, I was able to pay for legal support at a time where I knew that it would benefit people, because we were in a pandemic and I don't know if people were in a position to provide pro bono work at that time. And not to say that she wouldn't have, but she, you know, she didn't make it an obstacle and we didn't have any obstacles. So her bringing together the legal team for us, Jesse, Juan, the Oregon Justice Resource Center, all the people involved in the lawsuit here locally against the city of Portland, where we got to fuck 12. Those guys, thank you. Thank you to all the people that signed up on our volunteer list. I think we had over 700 legal professionals and other people that signed up during the time of the protests to volunteer to do work. And we were overwhelmed with the response. So right now, people like Dr. Anita are still like going through the list of people signing up for Safer Space and different programs that they want to be a part of. And we don't want you to stop signing up. So just know that we thank you. We're encouraging. Shout out to you, Michael, for helping us with some stuff that we're doing right now. What people don't know is, like, all summer long, youth that we were working with and other partners in our community, we were referring the long-term feasibility of those partnerships. We were asking them to connect with lawyers to kind of figure out how they wanted to be involved, because we knew that protests in our communities are kind of like seasonal. And what I know about seasonal is that it's not sustainable. And so we relied on different attorneys to help us with different issues in responding to mutual aid. And you were one of them. And I thank you for that. Kristen Chambers, who's like our board counsel and not an official board member, but sits on every committee call and board call and stays up with us via text every night. Thank you to all the work she's doing. Thank you to Demetria Hester, who fought a Nazi on TriMet and convicted that motherfucker. You know, your families that lost their loved ones, you know, and is leading protests in our community, even though she's from Memphis. She's out here on that Dr. King, you know, nonviolent stuff, you know, doing direct actions, keeping people's spirits up. Danny Cage and all the kids that are, you know, still working to recall Ted Wheeler and wanting to promote, you know, the right for children to vote for people that are 16 and over next up. Like everybody, you know, like we have a big community. So it's hard to say everybody, but for our Indigenous Rising, for, you know, everybody that's been involved and continues to center Black lives, especially in the whitest city in America, where it takes more effort to make us trend, where it takes more effort to make us have value, not as a monolithic and not only in trauma. Thank you for socializing and making that your commonplace. I see my community, you know, people that aren't Black feel safer in Portland now. And they tell me that all the time, like ever since all the signs started popping up and ever since, you know, what people call vandalism, but when the art started popping up, people let me know that they felt safer in our community in that response. And so, yeah, not to say go make art, more art, but just continue being a good neighbor. And thank you.
Yeah, that is the best shout out session that we've had. That was great. Well, I really appreciate you doing the podcast. And also just want to thank you again for all the great work that you do for the community. You know, people like you give me hope and remind me that there's duration and there's furtherance. So keep doing it. Keep pushing.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for having me. It was an honor. I really appreciate it. I was like, whoa. Thank you. Thank you for doing this work and for being there for us.
Have a good rest of the day. Hopefully you get some sun this week and you get to go outside.
Yep. All right, peace.
We would all like to thank Teresa Rayford for being on this episode of the podcast. For more information on Don't Shoot Portland, visit don'tshootpdx.org. There you can find ways to donate, sign up for upcoming events, and also receive a monthly newsletter. That's don'tshootpdx.org. Again, we want to extend a sincere thank you to X-Ray FM for the 2020 X-Ray Award. Check out all the good work they're doing at 91.1 FM, 107.1 FM, and online at xray.fm. And thank you for checking out this episode of All of Your Business. You can visit us at allofyourbusinesspodcast.com for previous episodes, sponsors, and much more. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast and share with your friends. This episode was recorded at JJT Studios and edited at Track 11 Music.